How did an agency that oversees managing office space and procuring supplies come to play such a role in the presidential transition? That and more today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.
I'm David Brown. Give me a T for transition. What changes and how for Team Biden with an election acknowledgement by a key government agency? Also, who Joe Biden's tapping for his administration and what it could mean for Texas. Mexico's president also slow to concede the outcome of the U.S. presidential election, what that could mean for relations with our crucial neighbors to the south. And before the family gatherings begin, a North Texas family offers a warning informed by experience. Those stories and more when the Standard gets underway, right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard Time on this 24th day of November 2020. I'm David Brown, getting ready to put the oven on preheat. Hope your Thanksgiving week is going smoothly so far. And so it begins. The big T formally underway. In this case, the T we're talking about stands for transition. No, President Trump has not yet conceded. But after weeks of delay, the head of the General Services Administration got the transition gears rolling yesterday with a letter officially declaring Joe Biden the apparent winner of the 2020 presidential election, a necessary step that gives Mr. Biden and his team access to resources that will permit the transfer of power. It is a process that is largely framed by a little-known law passed in 1963, the Presidential Transition Act, or PTA. And what happens now is shaped not just by law, but by precedent, too, notably the tricky and jagged transition from Bill Clinton to a certain former Texas governor you may have heard of. Here to help us understand more about this process is Jeffrey Engel. He is founding director of the Center for Presidential History and professor of history at Southern Methodist University. Professor Engel, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Hi, it's always good to talk to you.
Always good to talk with you, sir. Many listeners had never heard of the General Services Administration, or GSA, before now. How did an agency that procures supplies and manages office space come to have such a central role in the presidency?
Well, I think we all could have lived our lives happily without hearing about the GSA in the news. And that's the whole point of it. It's the office that provides staplers and paper and trucks and offices. So basically, it's how the federal government processes stuff and oftentimes processes money and resources as well. So in essence, if you needed offices, if you needed to have a bank account in order to pay people for the transition, you wouldn't go to any of the other executive branch functions. You would go to this one, which is for the entire government.
The head of the GSA, is that an appointed position? In other words, does the president have complete hiring and firing power?
Yes, that is an appointed position, and the president can basically put whomever they want there, which I think is one of the reasons why we saw this suddenly become politicized for the first time in our history, because the current GSA director, according to her testimony or her statements, had decided that she was going to act independently of Trump, but she wanted to wait until there was a propitious moment or a deciding factor that would allow her essentially political cover from her own president. And she decided the ruling yesterday over the weekend in Pennsylvania and the number of senators who came out yesterday in favor of a proper transition, that that was a political cover she needed in essence to be politically independent as she's supposed to be.
Can you recall it ever taking this long after an election for the GSA to get those wheels going?
No. I mean, the only comparable case would be when George W. Bush took over, of course, in 2000. There, we did not know who the next president was going to be formally until middle of December. What happened at that point was the GSA essentially said, okay, we don't know which one of these guys is going to be in charge, but we do know that they need to be ready on day one. So let's start prepping both teams. Maybe not to the fullest extent possible, but let's make sure they get national security briefings. Let's make sure that they get resource briefings, so that they are ready to go when the new transition occurs. And so typically, this is not a process that you or I should care about, because it's supposed to be the peaceful transfer of government. Doesn't just mean the person sitting in the Oval Office. It means handing the keys to the entire machinery to another group, and that's usually not witnessed by the public.
Does this, in your estimation, put a period on the election? I mean, if there's anybody who wonders whether or not it's okay for the country to acknowledge that Joe Biden is the president-elect, does this put an end to all of that?
You know, if anybody is still wondering that, I would encourage them to go read some of the federal court transcripts from the Trump administration's lawsuits. In almost every case, the judge, including many who were appointed by President Trump, have basically laughed the lawyers out of the court for just a pure lack of evidence. It's not that their arguments were bad, it's that their arguments were bad and they were not presenting any proof whatsoever. So this is a good marker. Another good marker, the one which I would say is kind of the final nail in the coffin, if you will, is when the Electoral College votes in mid-December. But anyone who is having any delusion over who's going to be president on January 21st needs to, unfortunately, come to the clear realization that the world is moving on.
Does the GSA's foot dragging, as many see it, change anything in the long run when it comes to presidential transitions?
I don't think it's going to change anything in the long run. It could change things in the short run, which is to say, it could make a little bit of difficulty for the Biden administration to get up and running. Though I think the bigger issue is not with the GSA. The bigger issue is that when you hand over power, the handing over administration has to decide if they want to be enthusiastic about that or not. George W. Bush's administration in 2008-2009 did an incredible job. They get an A+ for being helpful. Needless to say, the Obama administration tried to be helpful, I think, in 2016-17 with the incoming Trump team, but the incoming Trump team, frankly, did not have a lot of people with a whole lot of government experience at the top, so I'm not sure that they were paying too much attention to the advice they were getting. So all is to say, Donald Trump still can affect whether or not the transition goes peacefully or combatively.
Jeffrey Engel is founding director of the Center for Presidential History and professor of history at Southern Methodist University. Professor, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Always good to talk to you.
As you might imagine, a presidential transition comes with quite the to-do list. And toward the very top is filling out the president-elect's cabinet. Yesterday, the Biden administration announced its picks for several cabinet positions, most of them veterans of the Obama administration. They include Alejandro Mayorkas, who, if confirmed, will be the first Latino to head the Department of Homeland Security, Linda Thomas-Greenfield as ambassador to the United Nations, John Kerry as special envoy for climate, and Avril Haines, who will be the first woman to be the director of national intelligence. Joining us now to tell us more about these picks and what they might mean for Texas, Richard Pineda. He's the director of the Sam Donaldson Center for Communication at the University of Texas, El Paso. Professor Pineda, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Great to be here, David.
What clues do these appointments give us about the direction and priorities of a Biden administration and what that means for Texas?
Well, I mean, I think that the most important thing is it communicates stability. And I think that there's a marked difference at this point than where we were 4 years ago after the Trump administration was elected in terms of experience and people that understand government policy and government bureaucracy. This is, I guess, the perfect antidote to draining the swamp. I'm not sure that it'll win any favors with conservative politicians in the United States. But I think for folks that are looking at this internally and even from outside the United States, there is a whole roster of fairly qualified people in these positions so far. I also think, you know, that the factors that in Texas, I think we really want to pay attention to, the president has yet to name an ambassador to Mexico or a U.S. Mm-hmm. trade representative. And to a certain extent, there's going to be obviously some significant top tier cabinet secretaries. But I think for those of us watching the internal mechanics of how this administration is going to intend to work, I think those two positions are going to be crucial, especially for Texans, because I think we've got a lot on the line when it comes to trade with Mexico and where we sit in terms of our relationships with our large trading partner to the south.
These are people who are Beltway insiders, I think, as by and large, as I understand it. And yet we have some people who bring to their desks very interesting distinctions. I mentioned Mayorkas, one of the first picks who, if confirmed, would be the first Latino to head the Department of Homeland Security, this department of particular interest to Texans, of course. What can we expect from it being led by Mayorkas?
Well, I think Mayorkas is important for two really big reasons, David. The first is he comes into this position with previous experience running the Citizenship and Immigration Services branch of our immigration process. So he understands asylum and some of the questions that are tied up with how people transition into the United States as immigrants. Also, I think that he portrays kind of a unique story. He himself is a Cuban immigrant who came right after the Cuban Revolution. And so as a child, I think he has had a unique experience with this process. I think that he'll be compassionate and I think bring some change there.
Of course, a lot of this presumes that the president-elect will be able to get his nominees past the Senate. How difficult of a time do you think Joe Biden will have getting their approval?
You know, I think that's the million-dollar question, David, and I think that's one of the reasons that you are seeing folks that have had previous White House experience. The conventional wisdom is that when you've got somebody who's already gone through some part of the vetting process or, in fact, has already been confirmed in some capacity, that it's a much easier argument to make. Right now, I think from a rhetorical perspective, the president-elect is trying to balance out his interest to get the country back on track as he sees it, but he's also going to have to, in some of these picks and possibly picks in the next couple of days, extend an olive branch to Republicans, especially in the Senate, that may not be happy with the end outcome. And I think the other challenge that's kind of implicit in that particular issue is the president also is going to run the risk of upsetting folks on the progressive left. So it's this weird moment of threading the needle. Remember, this coalition coming into the election was a little bit wobbly. And I think it's gonna start to press on both sides. So the president-elect has a very challenging list of things to do, as you say.
Richard Pineda is the director of the Sam Donaldson Center for Communication at the University of Texas, El Paso. Professor Pineda, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out of your day to talk with us on the Texas Standard, and happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving, David.
Social media editor Wells Dunbar joins us now with a look at the talk of Texas. Hello, Wells.
Hi, David. Well, as we've been discussing, after weeks of court challenges, it appears the Trump administration is working towards handing things off to the Biden presidency. And so our friends and listeners are telling us what they think about these developments on our Facebook page. Denise J. Rowe says, it's about time. John Davis says that Trump knew he lost. He just wanted to cause as much chaos as possible before he leaves, comparing him to the type of person who gets kicked out of a party and purposely knocks things over on his way out. Meanwhile, Jonna Blackley says, I think the president's been advised that holding up the transition could open him up to legal challenges. But he adds, I doubt he'll ever concede the election result himself, as it could seriously hurt his fundraising chances among his followers. Several other comments and takes coming in on this news. Heading into the Thanksgiving break for many folks. We're also hearing about that as well, David, and I'll be back with more responses from social media later in the show.
Your take before the break, you know the one we're talking about. Tweet us or look for us on Facebook or your social media platform of choice. Texas Standard's what you're looking for, and Wells Dunbar's looking for you. He'll be back in 35 with more of the Talk of Texas.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. For weeks, medical professionals have been warning folks that gathering with friends and family during the holidays could lead to a higher number of COVID-19 cases. And now a North Texas family is cautioning others about what they went through after a recent gathering. KERA's Hadi Mawagde reports.
Alexa Aragones has a message for families planning to get together for the Thanksgiving holiday.
COVID-19 can change a family dynamic in an instant.
Aragones has firsthand experience. Recently, a dozen of her family members got together for a belated birthday celebration. It was supposed to happen outdoors, but ended up happening inside her cousin's home. No one wore a mask, and all 12 family members, including her mom, got sick.
One moment you're okay and you're breaking bread and having fajitas, the next moment the matriarch of your family is feeling sick and ill, and it's been heartbreaking.
Her mom was the only one who required hospitalization. She had a 103-degree fever for days and eventually was diagnosed with pneumonia. Her mom's out of the hospital now, but Aragonés says she's not quite back to normal.
She said that she woke up with a lot of pain in her chest still, and is still really exhausted from everything, and it's hard for her to focus.
Aragonés, fortunately, was not at the party and did not get sick. Still, she's learned a lot from this experience, but she hopes that her near tragedy helps others from making a similar mistake. I'm Hadi Mawagdi in Dallas.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider, proud to be on the job with Texans who are working safe and keeping communities strong. More at texasmutual.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Since Election Day, there's been a lot of focus on how Latinos and Latinas voted in Texas and nationwide, as well as the turnout of suburban women. Those are not mutually exclusive categories of voters, of course, but it just might take a few more election cycles for campaigns to get past the white soccer mom stereotypes, as the Texas Standard's own Joy Diaz reports after talking to her own friends, Latinas living in Texas's suburbs.
You know, your vote matters when the President of the United States singles you out.
So can I ask you to do me a favor? Suburban women, will you please like me? Remember? Please.
That last-minute appeal from the president came just days before this month's election. But these days, it takes more than a please to win someone's vote. Candidates, regardless of party affiliation, need to get to know their potential voters. As far as suburban women in Texas are concerned, we're a very diverse group. Take, for instance, suburban Latinas. I am one. Marcela Andres, who lives in Pflugerville, a suburb of Austin, is another.
I'm half Cubana and half Mexicana, and I was born in the United States, and so I have like this multicultural identity. I'm complex.
Like a fast-growing number of Latinas, we're both college-educated.
But...
Say it.
I went to Harvard Graduate School of Education and got my master's in education, focusing on organizational leadership and community advocacy.
So we don't have that in common.
Because we're different. We're different Latinas. We are.
Just to show you how different, those of us who are mothers celebrate Mother's Day on different days. If your heritage is from the Dominican Republic, you'll celebrate in June. From Costa Rica, in August. From Argentina, in October. Panama?
We celebrate in December Day, totally different from pretty much every other woman.
Fatima Wilson lives in Georgetown, another Austin suburb. Both of these ladies voted in the presidential election. But Marcela Andres voted for President-elect Joe Biden, while Fatima Wilson voted for President Donald Trump. Even my sister, Jennifer Jacobus, and I are different. Though on the surface, we share many things, down to our DNA. Like Wilson and Andres, we don't share our political views.
Do we vote the same?
No.
Do we have the same?
Heck no!
If we're so different, how can candidates appeal to suburban Latinas? Are voters asking too much of candidates when they want to be spoken directly?
That does make it sound like it's an impossible thing to do.
Valerie Martinez-Evers teaches political science at the University of North Texas. She's also the director of the Latino and Mexican American Studies program there.
I think the main thing would be start from a position of being culturally sensitive.
Marcela Andres agrees. She says the post-election analysis she's seen on TV about Latinos in Florida, who are mostly of Cuban descent, versus Latinos in Texas, who are mostly of Mexican descent, lacks nuance for her since she's both.
And so how dare you categorize my way of thinking or feeling with one group of people that have been put in this box? Like, that is not who I am.
Professor Martinez-Evers says it's incumbent upon candidates and parties to figure out who their potential voters are, and that can only happen if and when they develop a relationship with such voters.
Start from the position of, this is an educated person and I want to know their opinion and what they think is important.
Suburban Latinas think healthcare is important for themselves, for their children, for their parents. Education, safe neighborhoods.
We want our jobs or our companies, because lots of Latinas own their own businesses. They're entrepreneurs. We want our jobs or our companies to do well.
At the moment, businesses are not doing well. At La Flaca, a suburban organic farm near my house, I meet Alejandra Rodriguez Bauten. You can probably tell from my steps crunching the ground that everything at the farm is dead.
Yeah, so this used to be my farm, La Flaca. It's a sustainable farm. We grew edible flowers, peppers, and culinary herbs for local restaurants. But when COVID hits, we lost 90% of our sales overnight.
The farm is currently abandoned, and Rodriguez Bauten says that's how she feels too, abandoned by politicians.
I don't feel there's too much outreach going on to make authentic relationships with the Latino community.
During this past election cycle, she just observed from the periphery because she's not a citizen yet, but she's on the process of becoming one, and was disheartened to see how Republicans assumed Texans would vote for President Trump. After all, this is the reddest of red states. And how Democrats assumed Texans would vote for Joe Biden, even when he didn't make an appearance in the state. Rodriguez Bauten wants support for small businesses, help with her property taxes so she can keep her farm. But that is not going to happen.
The only option is bulldozing the farm. Yeah.
Even though her farming world and the political world seem diametrically opposite from each other, Rodriguez Bauten, who has an MBA, says there are lessons in farming for anyone hoping to earn the vote of suburban Latinas.
Absolutely. First off, you have to know your soil. You have to know your voters, your constituents, and, you know, growing that relationship takes time. You have to plant the seed and nurture it and grow it if you want to harvest anything from that.
If politicians start planting now, by the time Rodriguez Bauten is a citizen, which is only a matter of time, they may be able to harvest her vote. I'm Joy Diaz for the Texas Standard.
Well, the U.S. Supreme Court is not buying Walmart's argument that a Texas law barring publicly owned companies from selling liquor discriminates against out-of-state retailers. Texas is the only state with that law on the books. Though the justices rejected Walmart's discrimination claim on Monday, the retail giant will continue its long-running challenge to the Texas law in federal trial court.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. A federal appeals court is letting Texas kick Planned Parenthood out of its Medicaid program. KUT's Ashley Lopez reports Planned Parenthood officials claim the state's decision was political.
State officials kicked Planned Parenthood out of the program after the release of a misleading and highly edited video created by anti-abortion advocates in 2015 that purported to show Planned Parenthood officials selling fetal tissue. A district court had previously blocked the state from removing Planned Parenthood, but the conservative Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals has blocked that ruling. Judges on the Fifth Circuit claim that legal precedent disqualifies Medicaid beneficiaries from taking issue with how states determine what providers are qualified to be in the program or not. In a statement, Planned Parenthood officials said kicking them out of the program is a blatant political attack that will jeopardize critical health care access for Texans with low incomes during a global pandemic. The group also noted the order has yet to take effect, and they will continue to serve patients for now.
Ashley Lopez reporting. Lubbock, which is facing an ongoing surge in coronavirus cases, expects to get more of a COVID-19 antibody therapy drug next week after receiving more than 140 doses. The city's mayor, Dan Pope, says they're targeting select individuals for treatment.
The Eli Lilly drug is targeted for people that have been just tested positive within the last 5 days and are over the age of 65, and you'll see it focused on nursing homes also.
Governor Greg Abbott was in Lubbock last week to announce the arrival of the antibody therapy in Texas. United Airlines plans to begin offering mail-in COVID-19 tests to passengers traveling from Houston to certain destinations in Latin America and the Caribbean. That's so they meet local entry requirements upon arrival. Rodney Cox is United's Vice President of Operations at George Bush Intercontinental Airport. He explains why they're offering the testing.
We have a significant population in Houston that has families in the Latin Americas and the Caribbean who want to travel, and they've not been able to receive timely tests in order to meet the restrictions within 72 hours of testing negative to actually get into the country.
Travelers can request a test starting for flights departing Houston on December 7th. It costs $119. McKinney has begun virtual jury trials to avoid a backlog in cases during the pandemic. The Dallas Morning News reports the North Texas city was the first in the state to do so this month. Texas has barred in-person jury trials for justice and municipal courts until at least February 1st.
You're listening to statewide news from public radio stations across Texas. This coverage is only possible because of support from listeners like you. You can help sustain and grow Texas news coverage by donating to your local public radio station today.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. 30 years ago, Congress passed a law called the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, perhaps better known by the acronym NAGPRA. The idea was to help indigenous people reclaim the remains and possessions of their ancestors that were in the possession of places like museums and universities. The premise was well-intentioned, but the execution has been incomplete, especially in Texas. Joining us now to tell us more is Amal Ahmed. She is a reporter for the Texas Observer. Amal, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you for having me.
You recently wrote about this law for the Observer. Tell us how it's designed to work versus how it's actually working in Texas.
Yeah, so NAGPRA is a law that was passed 30 years ago. This year is the 30th anniversary, and Native American and indigenous activists and experts, really pushed for this as a human rights law to kind of rectify centuries of plunder, essentially, from grave sites around the country. So the law gives federally recognized tribes the right to consult with museums and go through this process to reclaim, remains that they've held. But the law doesn't extend the same right to state tribes. And so that's kind of where a lot of, the issues are coming up, is that in Texas, we actually don't have a state process for recognizing tribes. And so it's a much more sort of, obscure process of how tribes can reclaim the remains in Texas.
Just to be clear about this, what you're saying is that there are to draw the distinction, there are federally recognized tribes, and then there are other tribes in Texas which haven't received that federal recognition. And in Texas, there really isn't a vehicle for state recognition, or hasn't been conferred very often in the past?
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, federal recognition is a process that can take a very long time and, requires a lot of resources, essentially, to go through this process at the federal level. And there's no agency in Texas that does this. Like in some other states, there are commissions and whatnot in other states that can do this, but we don't have that here in Texas.
If there were a commission with the power to issue official recognition, would that be covered under NAGPRA, or does it have to be a federally recognized tribe?
Yeah, so NAGPRA doesn't officially, extend to any tribes that aren't federally recognized. So state tribes can sort of use the same process, but essentially the museum or university would have the right to refuse to engage with a tribe that doesn't have that recognition, if that makes sense. That's kind of what we're seeing in Texas, right? So one example being the Miacan Garza band. Essentially, they can go to a museum and say, we know that you have a certain set of remains that we believe to belong to our tribe, right? But the university can then say, well, you're not a federally recognized tribe, and so we don't have to engage with you. Whereas if a federally recognized tribe came to the university, they would have to start that process of talking with them and sort of figuring out, what is the best course of action.
It sounds like you've talked with members of tribes that aren't federally recognized. What have you heard from them when it comes to their experiences?
Yeah, so a difficult thing is that a lot of the history of these tribes that don't have federal recognition, a lot of it has been lost just to, centuries of cultural genocide and occupation. So I spoke with people from the Coaltecan tribe here, which is kind of present in and around San Antonio. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there were textbooks which would said that the tribe was extinct, right? So the idea of biological extinction, meaning that people from the tribe had all died off, or cultural extinction, which is, you know, essentially cultural genocide, right? Like they had all been forcibly assimilated into, you know, Spanish colonial culture. And so this tribe no longer existed, right, on paper. And that certainly hasn't been true, right? Like there are ways in which, you know, the culture and lineage of that tribe has existed, even if it hasn't been recognized. So folks like Ramon Vasquez are in the story, right? Like he's kind of also reclaiming that history and sort of having to reestablish that identity, right? Which certainly makes the process of repatriation harder.
Is there anything the Texas legislature could do in this regard to sort of close the gap, if you will?
Yeah, so I talk about this a bit in the piece. You know, in California, just this year, they passed a new state law that essentially expands the requirements for state-funded institutions to work with state tribes and sort of fill the gap that the federal law has left. So, I mean, certainly in Texas, it would be kind of starting from scratch just because we don't have that same kind of like infrastructure built in already. The first step would sort of be fixing that, you know, lack of any sort of recognition of state tribes.
Amal Ahmed is a reporter for the Texas Observer. We'll have a link to her story at texasstandard.org. Amal, thanks again for your time.
Thank you.
Well, 2020 is about to be in the rearview mirror. How should we mark the year that was? Well, some Texas artists have an idea, and it involves a dumpster. That story and more coming up next as The Standard continues.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, presenting the Intersect Ed Podcast, where the stories of Texas public education policy and practice meet. Available at raiseyourhandtexas.org/podcast and most podcast platforms.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Last Friday was the Transgender Day of Remembrance, a day to honor those lives lost to anti-trans violence. More than 200 trans and gender nonconforming people have died due to such violence in the last 7 years, and when it comes to those numbers, Texas leads the nation. KERA's Becca Moore reports.
Emmett Schelling is a trans man and an advocate for his community, so he's regularly harassed and receives threats. He ironically calls them love letters.
They don't know who I am. They don't know who loves me or what good I'm contributing to the world.
Schelling heads the Transgender Education Network of Texas, which advocates for gender diverse equality.
There's a specific kind of hurt to know that not just this person sending this, but a whole population of people just blindly hate you.
This year has been one of the deadliest on record for trans and gender nonconforming people, with at least 37 killed. Since 2013, a staggering 85% of victims were people of color. In Texas, at least 15 trans people have been killed in the last 5 years. A third of those deaths happened in the Dallas area. Most recently, 22-year-old Mercy Mack, a Black trans woman, was killed in June. But why is this problem so much worse in Texas? Schelling says state lawmakers and others in power often vilify the trans community. He points to misinformation spread during the 2017 debate over the bathroom bill.
Like, of course that's going to feed into violence. Because what you've essentially said is these people are not people, really. These people are not as human as you and me. These people are not as worthy of dignity, of respect, of using a public bathroom without being criminalized.
Another problem?
Many Texans are not aware that LGBTQ people can legally be fired, refused housing, or denied simple services because of who they are.
That's Ricardo Martinez, CEO of Equality Texas, a political action group. He says without those basic protections, trans people have disproportionate rates of unemployment and homelessness, and less access to healthcare and public services, too. But that could change. The legislative session begins in January, and State Representative Jessica Gonzalez of Dallas has already filed a bipartisan bill to give sexual orientation and gender identity protected status. Supporters say it would be good for the economy.
You do get businesses having employees say, I'm not going to move my family to state X or Y because I don't feel safe there, or I don't feel safe for my kids there. So it again would demonstrate and make operations easier and sort of talent acquisition and management easier for big businesses.
That's Jessica Shortall, managing director for Texas Competes, an LGBTQ advocacy group. She says a new law could create 180,000 jobs and raise $2.8 billion in state taxes in 5 years. And she says 70% of Texans support the bill.
And that's majorities of Democrats and Republicans. It's majorities of every major faith group, including evangelicals.
But advocates say legislation is not the only solution. Education is also crucial. Just last week, the Texas State Board of Education voted for the first time in more than two decades to expand sex education. But they left out information about sexuality, gender identity, or consent. Martinez of Equality Texas says that's a problem.
It's about teaching not only sex, it's about self-acceptance, it's about self-esteem, it's about developing healthy romantic relationships, knowing how to navigate those, and then it's also about learning about sexual orientation, gender identity.
When LGBTQ youth are left out of the classroom, Martinez says they start to believe they are an other. Marginalizing people makes them easy targets. Advocates say dispelling misinformation and expanding legal protections around gender identity could start to make Texas safer for the trans community. I'm Becca Moore in Dallas.
Amid a pandemic, a national reckoning on racism and police violence, an election cycle that never seemed to end, and the appearance of an insect known as a murder hornet, 2020's been described as something of a dumpster fire. Andrew Weber of KUT Austin reports on some artists hoping to harness the collective uncertainty of the year and offer catharsis through robots, hammers, and, of course, dumpsters.
The concept for this performance was simple. Get some percussionists, put them in a dumpster, and see what happens.
I mean, this year has been a literal dumpster fire, so it's nice to show that metaphorically, but also it's cathartic to bang on things really loudly and hear other people bang on things.
This is Kyle Evans. He's one of the co-creators of this performance called Dumpster Fire.
I think there's a lot of frustration, a lot of pent-up energy that people can just release, and so that's why we're doing it.
Evans and his partners rented two dumpsters and set them about 70 feet apart. Then they enlisted a couple of percussionists. One of them is named Thor Harris. He's a longtime Austin musician who looks pretty much like his name would suggest. Braided long hair, pretty muscular build, and he's got a giant hammer. Well, multiple hammers.
Some of them are about the size of croquet mallets, and then some of them are like, you know, when you kill someone in a cartoon with a huge hammer, they're that big. They're just cartoon gigantic.
Thor is not lying. Before the show, he walked me through all the hammers he'd built.
And I'm going to go in there so that you can hear what it sounds like to hit to play with the giant hammer if you want.
Just so you're warned, Thor is wielding a 4-foot hammer with a massive tree trunk mallet.
That sounds good, right?
On the other side of the lot, Lyman Hardy, another longtime Austin musician, is sizing up the other dumpster.
It's a lot different than a drum kit, but surprisingly similar. I mean, you know, you have, like, kick. That's not nice. You got a snare. You know. So you just find these things. You got this little cymbal over here. Yeah, you have an incredible range of sounds.
But those aren't the only instruments. There's an array of 4 robotic hammers on each dumpster. They're hooked up to a computer to provide a backing beat. With the setup finished and the audience filling in the rows of socially distanced chairs in front of the two blue dumpsters, Kyle takes to the roof to start the show.
Thank you all for coming and enjoy the dumpster fire.
Throughout the show, Erin Hazel and her year-old son Elio danced to the droning wall of sound while smoke and lights filled the dumpsters. It's been a challenging year for Erin. She lost her job because of the pandemic, but she says it's been rewarding being there for her son.
2020 has been a wild ride.
his first year of life has been incomparable. I think it was great because he loves percussion and banging on things, and this was a great way for him to immerse and experience, and I think a safe way.
This is the first time she and Elio had gone out since the pandemic, since his birth. For her, it was a chance to forget, just for a bit, the dumpster fire this year has been.
Thank you, Austin. We love y'all. Yeah.
Thor says this may not be the last we see of the Dumpster Fire concert. They want to take the show on the road at some point. He says the show is a product of its time, but that he thinks the show will translate beyond this moment.
There's always a need for a huge release of angst and energy, and I think it came along at the right time.
I'm Andrew Weber in Austin.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, a statewide network that has been caring for Texans for more than 30 years. More than 55 physicians in the Austin area treat 26,000 cancer patients each year. More at TexasOncology.com.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. It's been almost a month since the presidential election in the U.S., and our closest neighbor just across the Rio Grande from us has yet to acknowledge that President-elect Joe Biden is about to take office in a matter of weeks. That's what we know, but what lies behind the curtain? Apparently a lot more drama than many might expect. For a bit of analysis, we've asked Alejandro Hope to join us. He's a security analyst based in Mexico City and a frequent commentator on things that are happening between the United States and Mexico. Alejandro, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Mexico's president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, better known as AMLO, has cited Mexico's no intervention policy when it comes to foreign affairs as a justification for not congratulating President-elect Biden. How do you read the reluctance of AMLO to make that call? Does he have a soft spot for President Trump, perhaps, as some have suggested?
Yes, I think there are many, many different facets to this. One is President López Obrador has little to no interest in international affairs. He has been very, very cautious with Donald Trump. He has avoided conflict at all costs. And there might even be some empathy between the two characters.
Ooh, empathy.
To the extent that they are both outsiders. Uh-huh. They both see themselves as people fighting the political establishment. But I don't think that's the driver. Now that we know that at the same time they were negotiating the release of General Cienfuegos and its return to Mexico, that starts to make more sense.
I think a lot of our listeners may not know much about what's going on with General Cienfuegos. He is Mexico's former Secretary of Defense, correct?
He held the post between 2012 and 2018. He's a soldier. He presided the Mexican equivalent of West Point. He has been the mentor of a couple of generations of the top brass in the Mexican army. So he's a very, very important individual in the Mexican armed forces.
And he had been held in the U.S. on what, drug trafficking charges and money laundering charges?
That is correct. He was charged with helping and abetting a minor character in the Mexican drug trafficking world while he was Minister of Defense.
So I think a lot of people were surprised by the fact that the Justice Department asked the judge in his case to let General Cienfuegos go back to Mexico. And
that is correct.
Some people were saying, huh, maybe this is a parting gift of sorts from President Trump to AMLO. What say you?
This is highly unusual. Let me put it this way. Actually, the DOJ cited as the reason to drop charges on General Cienfuegos sensitive and important foreign policy considerations, which, of course, begs the question of what were those?
What were those considerations?
Important, sensitive foreign policy considerations. Uh-huh. And the answer is that this was felt in the Mexican army as an affront to the institution. If the Mexican army had enough clout to protect General Cienfuegos in the U.S., then I think it has sufficient clout to protect him in Mexico.
You know what this reminded me of, sir? It reminded me a lot of the exchanges that used to be made during the Cold War between the U.S. and the Soviets. You know, you'd have some high-profile individual, you know, return to the U.S. and you'd wonder, huh, I wonder what I wonder what that was for, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, my guess is that even if there is no direct quid pro quo between the Biden recognition and the Cienfuegos case, many Democrats are going to read it that way.
Let me ask you something. Do you think that this portends something, some friction between a Biden administration and
I think the U.S.-Mexico relation, which is always complicated, is going to become more complicated because basically for Trump, to the extent that Mexico stopped migrant caravans, he didn't care less. When the Democrats come back to power, many more agendas will be involved in that. Things like human rights or the erosion of democratic norms and practices in Mexico, AMLO's constant attacks on the media are going to sound to Democratic ears as eerily Trumpist.
It is a fascinating story and one that obviously has implications for the U.S. in the middle of its own political transition. We've been talking with Alejandro Hope. He is an independent security analyst who's based in Mexico City. Thanks so much for taking time to speak with us on the Texas Standard, sir.
It's a pleasure. Thank you very much. Thank you very much to your audience for listening.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Wells Dunbar is our social media editor, and he has been monitoring what Texans are talking about on this Tuesday. Hello there, Wells.
Hello, David. Well, perhaps unsurprisingly, hearing from folks about a topic we've been addressing a fair amount here on the show, and that is the upcoming Thanksgiving holiday here amid the COVID-19 pandemic. And I have to say, most of the Texas Standard friends and listeners out there on social media planning some very safe holiday celebrations, which is heartening to hear. On our Facebook page, Lou Ellen Avery Forrest says there will be two of us and not the usual 18. We're aged 2 months to 93 years as a family, and we won't selfishly risk the life or health of any. There will be other times together, but not this year. And similarly, Craig Hartley says, nothing. 2020 is a dead loss, but a vaccine is on the horizon, and 2021 may be a bit brighter if we can convince folks to do the right thing. So obviously, you know, I think that with the holidays here and this, you know, surprising amount of good welcome vaccine news, I think some folks, you know, beginning to see a little bit of optimism here. We just got to get through this winter, it looks like, and the flu season and everything that comes along with that. And hopefully a return to normal, maybe on tap for 2021. Who knows, David?
Who knows? Who knows indeed? Hey, you know, if we haven't heard from you about your Thanksgiving plans, I'd be really interested in hearing. I'm sure Wells would, too. Just let us know. Look for Texas Standard on your social media platform of choice.
Decidedly so. And I wouldn't be remiss not to mention, though, we have some pretty interesting Thanksgiving plans of our own here on Texas Standard coming up. Tomorrow, we're going to have a nice recap of the best books of 2020. It's going to be a really awesome segment looking back at some of the really really interesting author interviews that we've conducted over the year here on the show. That's going to be really solid. Then on Thanksgiving Day, we're going to be looking back at our special looking at Asian Americans in Texas, Overlooked No More, really a rebroadcast of a really incredible show looking at all their contributions to the state. And then Friday, I believe, Ofrenda, revisiting our special to looking at the dawn of the Day of the Dead and its resonations here in the age of COVID-19 and the impact it's really left on the Hispanic community in Texas. So we really have a slate of really, really great programming coming up over the next 3 days here on The Standard.
Yeah, if you missed any of those broadcasts when they first were aired, the Asian Americans in Texas, the Ofrendas broadcast, this is an opportunity you'll definitely want to take advantage of. That's coming up on T-Day as well as Friday here on The Standard. Tomorrow we're digging into our library, and we hope you will join us for that. It's going to be a lot of fun. Till then, I'm David Brown along with the rest of the Texas Standard team, inviting you to join us 24/7 over at texasstandard.org.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Woldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington family.